How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Thank you so much for giving us the most precious thing you have, your time, as we do what we always do, try to turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to the information we need so that we can properly discern the times we live in. And there's a whole lot going on. Let's start with President Biden addressing the nation from the Oval Office, from behind the Resolute desk, as he pointed out to open his statements. This was hard to watch. Clearly, the president has declined in recent weeks. I know he's just coming off the COVID. I know he's had probably the darkest days of his political career as he came to the realization that he was being forced out, resigning, stepping down from the campaign, however you want to phrase it. He clearly didn't want to do it. He got to a point where he had to do it. He was talked into doing it, however you want to parse that out. Could not have been pleasant, must have been hard on him. His age and his mental acuity and his physical appearance, even from a few weeks ago, even from the debate, he looks a little more off than he did even there. The decline from President Biden earlier just this year to now is dramatic, which tells us it's probably worse than they're letting on, which anybody with a cognitive function could surmise. It's worse than we're letting on. And I didn't enjoy this one bit. I didn't like watching it. It was hard to watch. I don't want to see my president like that. We should not want to see our president like that. Now, he's going to serve out the last 6 months or so of his term. The argument for that is that he can focus on that without the stresses and travel of the campaign and just run the government as it is. And let's all be adults here. The president, by and large, by himself, you know, he makes the decisions. He's the shot caller, but there's this whole system around him. We've had figurehead presidents before. We've had more than a few figurehead presidents where somebody else was really running everything and they were just the political front or the face of it. You know, these are not the days of FDR where you could hide, where, you know, FDR was unable to stand and walk. They jury-rigged that for the cameras because you didn't have as much live video and that sort of thing. This is a new era. You just cannot hide the decline of the president. We could argue at some other point whether he should have resigned the presidency or not. I think he should have. If he's not fit to run, he should have went ahead and resigned. I understand the argument why not, but in the next 6 months, there's some really bad people in the world that will take advantage of the perceived weakness and the real weakness of a lame duck president who doesn't look like he's fully there right now. And I mean that with all possible due respect to President Biden. It's just the way the world works. Weakness breeds predators to come in and take advantage of that weakness. And we're going to look weak for the next 6 months with President Biden in the White House. But there's nothing to be done with that now. That's going to happen. We're going to move on to the presidential election. But it was hard to watch, and it reinforces why that debate was so devastating. Those of us who have had loved ones that are older, and that's almost everybody, because let's be honest, folks, if we linger long enough on this side of eternity, we are all going to get old. We are going to decline. Some of us had health issues much younger than old and understand these things. Some of us have had near-death experiences and understand these things, but you're going to decline. You're going to get old. You're going to get to a place where you can't do what you could do before. And I understand people coming out and defending Biden and said, well, I had a meeting with him and he was fine. It doesn't mean they were necessarily lying, although there has been some covering up of the president's condition, clearly. But these, when people in the elder state like this and with the sort of things that President Biden is dealing with, they can strap it up for short periods of time. And no doubt they went into the debate hoping he could just strap it up one more time and get through the debate. And he couldn't. But it was beyond just him struggling. I was watching that debate with people who were non-political in my household, and they were asking me to turn it off. Not because of the politics. They just couldn't watch it. It was that visceral. I had that same feeling watching this speech. Although the speech was fine, it was technically fine. But because I do media and I do TV and I do radio, you could just tell, you know, President Biden didn't know where to go with his eyes. He didn't know what to do with his hands. He had his hands placed a very specific way, the way he braced himself on the desk. I know that because I do that. I do things with my legs and my lower body and my back off camera because I'm very fidgety and I move. My hands shake also. So I try not to talk with my hands on camera. I have a fidget thing that I play with in my hands usually when I'm doing live video, especially really long ones like a panel show where I'm talking for 30 minutes, but it's only in 2-minute increments every 10 minutes. I actually have a pad on my office chair to push the small of my back forward so that I keep my posture up because I don't sit properly for long periods of time. So watching the technical aspects of how he presented that, he couldn't keep his eyes on the teleprompter and the camera properly. His face, they had obviously made him up to try to make him look as good as possible, but you could tell they had made him up heavily. It was hard to watch. It was sad to watch. I will say this at the same time, I admire that he's trying to soldier on through it, but this is something you're not going to be soldiering on and be able to pull off. It's just not there anymore. I don't want to see my president like this, and I hope we take the lesson that maybe it's time we start backing off this thing where we don't have honest conversations about aging government. We saw the absolute abomination of what they did to Senator Dianne Feinstein. That was gross. It was gross. Keeping that woman in power for the people that were around her when she was clearly in no condition to be so. And there's many other examples. Republicans do this. Democrats do this. This thing of having this agedocracy in Congress and in our elected officials is not healthy for the country. And it goes beyond politics. It goes to, we just don't have a healthy conversation understanding about age. At some point, it's time to step off. At some point, you just can't do it anymore. And just because you can do it for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour out of the day doesn't mean you can do it 24/7 in a job like the presidency. We've had relatively young presidents before Trump and Biden. Barack Obama was relatively young. Bill Clinton was relatively young. George W. Bush was relatively young. Go look at the pictures of those three men, among the youngest presidents in the modern era, and look what they look like when they left office after 8 years. They were all full-term presidents. Just look at how their physical appearance changed in 8 years. This job, the presidency, absolutely chews people up. And it was too much of an ask for President Biden, who ran chiefly as being not Trump. And there was age concerns then. And now they've caught up with everybody. So let's just all be honest about where we're at, how we got here, and not just put the political blame game on it, but put the electoral blame game on it. This was the trade-off. You didn't want Trump, who, by the way, is also probably too old to be president, but we'll debate that some other day. And he's morally unfit to be president, with President Biden, who had age and ability concerns. And they caught up with him. And a lot of people in politics, in media, in the commentariat, they got caught because they didn't want to believe what they knew to be true. And now here we are. The switch to Vice President Harris will assuage some of this. But I hope we don't miss the lesson. If we know somebody's not perfectly fit to be president and we excuse it off and let him be president anyway, whether it's the morality of Trump or the age of Biden, it always, always, always is going to catch up with us, we, the people. And here we are again. Let's learn the lesson. More Herd Tell right after this.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy and Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster.
That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. Let's talk about the state of the race now that Vice President Kamala Harris is the top of the Democratic ticket. She's the presumptive nominee. That's a technicality. At the convention, they will officially, or if they still do the roll call beforehand like they were planning to do with Biden, we're not sure yet which way they're going to do it. I suspect they'll do it the traditional way now because they're going to want that big public display of it. But the big thing here is this is a done deal. Very quickly, you saw one of the prerequisites for being a national candidate. Kamala Harris's whip operation wrapped this thing up in about 36 hours. Now, clearly, they probably had a bit of a heads up. They've also been planning this for quite some time. If they had any sense at all, knew this could have been a possibility at any time. But they jumped in. They got these delegates rounded up. The delegates are pledged, although they're not officially voted yet. That'll come here in a week and a half or so when we get to the DNC. But it was impressive, and the money flowed, and this got wrapped up quickly. That's important for the Democratic Party for a couple of reasons. One is you didn't want to have an open contested convention. That's messy for everybody. Two is if they even attempted to skip over Vice President Harris, it would have ripped the Democratic coalition and the party apart. I had openly wrote that I think they should have just wrote it out with Biden, took the loss, and focused on trying to save the House and then try to win the midterms, because historically, the midterms, you're going to do very well in. So you could have focused on that and just taken the L. And if Vice President Harris loses to Trump by a few less points than what President Biden was looking like he might have lost in a landslide to him, I'm not sure all this is worth it, but nevertheless, here we are. Now, she can win. She's on the ballot. She may win. But let's have a grown folk talk about the situation she finds herself into. Kamala Harris of 2019 did not make it in the calendar year 2020 for the 2020 election. There was a lot of hype about her online popularity, how she was going to excite the youth vote, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It did not translate past anything other than headlines and media hits. And she didn't even make it to Iowa. She didn't even make it into the calendar year. She withdrew from the race when she ran out of support and ran out of the important money she had. And she had big time backers. She had a lot of the Clinton machine, those folks that were behind her candidacy, and it just didn't work out. Also want to point out how the rest of that race went, because it's important. Remember, Bernie Sanders was winning that race and the Democratic primary voters. It wasn't Republicans. It wasn't moderates. It wasn't independents. It wasn't the media. It was primary Democratic voters who found Kamala Harris wanting in 2019. Bernie Sanders looked like he was going to win that race. The party looked into the abyss of what that would look like and ran, not walked, to the polls to elect Joe Biden. And then Joe Biden ended up winning the presidency. That's how 2020 went down. Joe Biden then elected to pick Vice President Harris as his running mate. So why do I bring all that up? A couple things. Because a lot of the headlines we're seeing now are headlines we saw then, and they're true and not true just as much as they were true and not true then. Now, she's not the same candidate. She's been in a high-profile situation. She's been doing, yes, the job of vice president is chiefly ceremonial, but it is out in the public. It does have the travel. It does have the media. She has had a couple different things. They've done a couple different quote-unquote reboots to try to give her. One was on the border, and that's one she's getting beat up on right now, hard and heavy from the right, and there's justification for that. But she's not the same candidate. She's been around a little bit more now. The stories have already started, though, on how her online ability, the K-Hive, the TikTokers, all that. Well, remember, she had all that in 2019, and it didn't work out very well. And there's also all these stories about her electability. That's a code word for she's a woman, and she's a woman of color, and is the public going to do that because they didn't elect Hillary, they elected Trump. There's validity to this to a point. Yes, there are people who will not vote for a woman for president for all sorts of not good reasons. Hillary Clinton, however, she also had some of the highest unpopularity numbers that we have ever seen. Well, at least until Trump and Biden decided to run against each other again. She had really high negatives. She had been in the public spotlight for better part of 20 years, good, bad, and indifferent. I don't think that's a perfectly fair comparison. So, yes, there's people that will not vote for Kamala Harris because she's a woman, but that's not going to be the chief reason she wins or loses the election. Is there people that won't vote for her because she's a person of color? She has Jamaican and South Asian ancestry. Yeah, there's people who have prejudices, and prejudices on a spectrum going from ignorance and not knowing any better all the way down to wicked, vile racism. And we're going to see all of that in the course of events here. We've already seen some of it on social media. So there are people that will not vote for her just because of her color. There are people that will not vote for her because of her gender. That's inarguable. Are those going to be the biggest factors on whether she wins or loses? I don't think so. She is going to benefit greatly from one thing in 2019 that sunk her candidacy then that will help her tremendously this time. Part of her 2019 problem was, and this is just objectively fact, I'm sorry if this upsets you, she never articulated why she was running for president. That is the base alloy to any successful presidential campaign. Why are you running for president? You have to answer that. Joe Biden won it because he was running to beat Donald Trump. Just being not Donald Trump wasn't enough to overcome the decline of President Biden, and he's now stepped aside because he was going to lose this election. Not being Donald Trump is her reason for running for president. Now, there's going to be a lot of the aspirational stuff, first woman president, whatever the agenda she lays out. She's going to lean heavily on her prosecutorial record. She's going to try to co-opt some of the things from the Biden administration that she's proud of. Those are all normal political things. But the reason she's running for president is to keep Donald Trump from being president. And that's her best winning argument, is to be not Donald Trump. But that's not going to be enough to win. That's going to get her close. It's going to get her closer than Joe Biden has been polling wise for the last few weeks, especially. And this, let's be honest, before the debate, this race was pretty static, that Trump was winning pretty comfortably, somewhere in the 3 to 5 point range. And he was up in all the swing states except for one. And he was tied in that one. So where does that leave us now? We have recycled headlines that are the same, things like her online presence, things like, you know, the sexism and racism. That stuff will translate over, and we should judge and discern it appropriately. Yes, she may do better online than some folks, but she's still going to have to put together a coalition. I've talked about it over and over again since I started doing politics publicly. This is why I never bought into Nikki Haley. This is why Trump surprised people, because his coalition is different than any coalition we'd ever seen before. This is why Joe Biden won, because he put together a traditional Democratic coalition to win. Vice President Harris is going to have to put together a coalition of voters, and it's going to be slightly different than the Joe Biden one. She'll get most of them, but she's got to get some more of them, and the more of them to get over the hump from just not being Trump, which will get her within 2 or 3 points, to beating Trump, which she's going to need another 5 or so points to really solidify, because remember, she's got to win the Electoral College in those swing states. She's going to have to sell herself, and she's going to have to sell a vision, and she's going to have to, frankly, need some help. Now, the good news for the Harris campaign is Donald Trump likes to help out his opponents by shooting himself in the foot. We were subjected to new tone for about the fourth or fifth time in my life, right around the RNC, that Trump was going to have a new tone. And he had a new tone for the first 20 minutes of his RNC speech. And then he went back to being Donald Trump for the remaining nearly hour and a half of a nearly 2 hour speech. I literally just turned it off and went to bed, because I'd heard it all and I could guess what he was going to say after that. This race between Trump and Harris is going to get ugly. It's going to be nasty. It's going to play into all of those little innuendos and dog whistles and all that stuff. Not everybody, but the online people especially, are going to get really ugly with the thing, and they already have in some respects. How much is that going to affect the actual race? Well, it could. Donald Trump traditionally does very poorly with women voters. If it's seen that he's being very unfair to the female candidate, that could hurt him with that demographic. Kamala Harris has to show that she can win demographics that Trump is very strong on in the Midwest, blue-collar workers, people who might be a little more liberal socially but conservatively on things like economics. She can get those votes, but she's got to go earn them and work for them and get them. Can she get the old blue dog Democrats that Trump has done well with and get them back into the fold? She's a lot more progressive in her electoral and progressive and office-holding history than Joe Biden was. Joe Biden has drifted further and further to the left, but he drifted. Kamala Harris naturally just lives there. She's going to have to explain that to moderate voters who are a little squishy in the middle. She may have some of the same problem that Joe Biden had of, just because people aren't going to vote for Trump doesn't mean they're going to come out and vote for her. There may be a lot of split ticketing. They may not vote for her specifically, but people on the down ballot. These are the challenges that Kamala Harris is going to be facing
going into this election. Now, she can overcome them. She can win, but she is behind, and she's starting in a hole that Joe Biden left her in electorally. Now, the enthusiasm gap will close some of that quickly, but at some point right around after the DNC, and I've said this, I'm not going to pay a lot of attention to the polling until after the DNC because it's going to bounce around. Ask yourself this question. Did the fundamentals of this race really change when Joe Biden stepped off? And I don't mean since the debate when it was apparent that he couldn't do the job anymore. Talking about before that, this race has been very static since the spring. Trump has been consistently ahead. I think we're going to find come August and September that Vice President Harris is going to be in a similar situation, a few points behind, trying to figure out a way to break through in those seven key swing states. Can she do it? We'll find out. But she's only got about 100 days to do so. And we have a whole brand new election to try to analyze and figure out. Maybe we should start with where we ended up with the Biden campaign and see if the fundamentals of this race are really all that different, even with the shiny new object on top of the ticket to pay attention to. And Trump is still Trump. Trump still has his ceiling. There are people who will never vote for Trump no matter what. But that still might, that ceiling might be enough to win here. See what happens. More Herd Tell right after this. Welcome back to Herd Tell. I want to talk about this Sonia Macy video for a minute. If you're not familiar, this is a woman in her home in Springfield, Illinois. She was shot to death by a Sangamon County Sheriff's deputy. There was another deputy there, although he didn't fire the shots. Sean Grayson is the name of the deputy. He's now been charged with murder, among other charges. The video came out a couple of days ago. I'll be honest, I actually missed the video coming out because it was during the period of time the Friday before the Saturday that Trump got shot was the last day I was supposed to work for about 10 days because I had to go move my daughter from her house in Virginia to Ohio, then come back to West Virginia, set up for the wedding. And we had the wedding and she got married a couple hours after Biden resigned. So I picked a good 10 days to take off, right? Because some of the biggest news stories of the last few years came out. That's okay. So I actually missed the video release. One of the media outlets I work with, the News Forum up in Canada, asked for me to do some commentary on it. They sent me the link, and that was the first time I'd actually watched the video, although I remember the case when it initially happened. This shooting is horrific. It is has some common threads to other shootings we have, and I want to expand on the commentary I did for the Canadian folks because that's a, you know, little two-minute soundbite with one question. There are common threads to these police shootings that keep popping up over and over and over again. This woman, Sonia Macy, was clearly having some kind of a mental health issue or a mental health moment, or at the very least, cognitively wasn't fully understanding what was going on around her and the situation that she was in. Maybe she was trying to joke around with it. The rebuke you in the name of Jesus clip really hit me. That's something every old person I ever met growing up said. It's something I say in jest a lot. Like, I don't know if she was having a mental health moment or she was very scared and nervous and that was a joking moment because she immediately apologized for saying it when the police officer, the deputy that ended up murdering her, took offense to it. That hit home. One of the first things she said on the porch was, "Don't hurt me." So I'm paraphrasing here. You can watch the clip for yourself. I'm going to link to the full video. But we now know that this deputy had a lot of red flags. He had two DUIs before he was ever on the police force. He was in the Army, but didn't serve his full term. Although they said it wasn't, they didn't have a disciplinary record on it. There's some kind of a story there. I guarantee you there is, because they don't let you out early. For, you know, no good reason. It was probably one of those things like, look, we'll give you an honorable discharge. Just please go away. I suspect, that's a guess, but I suspect that happened because he didn't fill his full 2 years. You can go look that up on your own time. He had worked for multiple departments before getting his current job. That in and of itself doesn't mean a lot. A lot of smaller department people double up on their jobs because of the lower pay or part-timeness or whatever.
What we do know from this video is this person had no business being a police officer. They don't have the temperament for it. The escalation of the use of force here was completely disproportional. There was no threat to these officers. They failed to control her. If they did think she was a suspect, they didn't control her. One of the things they teach you, whether it's police or military or anything else, is if you're dealing with somebody in a house, you don't, if, and remember, this started on their front porch and then they went into the home. You don't let somebody go in the kitchen because the kitchen is where there's danger. There's knives, there's stoves, there's all sorts of things. So why did you let her? You should have kept her separate from that. There's two deputies, mind you. So she starts talking about boiling water on the stove. All the deputy had to say was, you stay here, I'll turn the stove off for you, walk over and take care of it. Or predominantly, the other deputy probably should have walked over towards the kitchen to keep her in the living room away. Now, you can say this is all Monday morning quarterbacking, but no, you wear a badge and a gun. You have the authority of the state as the armed enforcement arm of the law and of the state. This is what you're taught to do, and if you don't do it, you're allowed to be held accountable for it. We must hold you accountable for it. The idea that this woman needed to be shot when you watch the totality of the video is ridiculous. The full escalation of this situation was on the deputy. At any point, they could have de-escalated this. They could have calmed this whole thing down. They could have treated this woman completely differently and avoided all this. And there's no version of any of this where she deserved to have a bullet put in her head. When she ducked down behind the counter, that's a defensive posture. If she came up with a weapon, that'd be a little different. And again, the Monday morning quarterbacks and the people who think police can do no wrong will be like, well, you don't know. No, this is what you're trained to do. The murder charge in this situation is completely warranted. We will see if it brings a conviction. That's up to a court of law. But whatever happens in the court case of Sean Grayson, it's not going to be justice. There is no justice in this world for what happened to Sonya Macy, who called for help and wound up being killed for it. Because the deputy that responded, and to a lesser extent the partner, didn't do the one thing our police should always do. Keep the peace. More Herd Tell right after this. Welcome back to Herd Tell. We had protests in D.C. Benjamin Netanyahu was addressing Congress, and they call themselves pro-Palestinian protesters, but when you're spray painting Hamas is coming on the Columbus Fountain in front of Union Station, you're not pro-Palestinian, you're being pro-terrorist. Interestingly enough, ordinary-times.com, editor-in-chief emeritus Bert Lyko, who I respect tremendously, he has clear-the-deck privileges with the new managing editor, who's me. As the previous editor, anytime he wants to write anything, he's welcome to do so. He can do so, and he did. And he has a piece that I think applies to this in a certain way, these protests. And I'm really fearful of what's going to happen at the DNC. I want to talk about ethical equivocal stuff because he brought an ethical question that's on the Eton entrance exam. That's one of the elite schools in Great Britain, where a disproportionate amount of the prime ministers have gone to school, including Boris Johnson recently. And it's a question about how you would deal with protesters as an elected official, as the prime minister over there. I want to pause here before I get into this and just say one thing about the Hamas stuff. The Israeli, Gaza, Palestinian, the West Bank, and even though it's slightly different, applies to this. This is a very complicated issue with no good answer. And anybody tells you they have a good, clean answer is lying to you or is ignorant or is a fool. Israel is a sovereign nation that has a right to defend itself. Israel as a sovereign nation also has a responsibility as a democracy to keep their people in line and to do things a certain way that fits into the world order. I believe and support in the idea of Israel. But Israel, the country, and the elected leadership of Israel has to be accountable for what they do. They don't get a free pass just because a lot of the world hates them. And on big parts of the Middle East, like Iran, would like to wipe them off the map. I'm aware of that. They still have to adhere to norms and things. They don't get to just do whatever they want to do because they're being persecuted.
I am completely done with people telling me they care about the Palestinian people, but they can't condemn Hamas. Hamas uses the Palestinian people and dead Palestinians to further their cause. They don't care if Palestinians die, because the more Palestinians die, the stronger they get. The more Palestinians the Israelis kill, the more civilians the Israelis kill. That helps Hamas. And Hamas provokes, does not excuse Israel's part in it, but Hamas purposely provokes, purposely puts up human shields, purposely makes sure lots and lots of dead babies and dead women and children and dead people in Gaza, so that they can get more and more power. Hamas is evil, wicked, and needs to be wiped off the face of the earth. And if you can't say that very basic statement, you don't care about Palestinian people. You don't care about Palestinian statehood. You don't care about the people in Gaza. You just don't like Israel so much that you want to support a terrorist organization that's murdering people. Yes, I understand the Israelis have killed people too, but they're a sovereign state. We can hold them accountable. How do you hold Hamas accountable? If you spray paint "Hamas is coming," you are openly supporting terrorism. That's no longer protesting. That's a terroristic threat. That's a different thing. But back to ordinary times. Bert Lyko wrote this: "We freshly addressed issues of moral fitness to hold power over others here in these United States. So as one will do, I think of Mother England." Okay, not really, but seriously, I do think about leadership relatively often, what good leadership looks like, what bad leadership looks like, why bad leaders make the decisions they do. Back in 1441, Henry VI ordered that a school be founded to educate up to 70 poor boys a year at crown expense. Today, that school is called Eton College. I'm reading Bert Lyko in ordinary-times.com. We will link to it. And it's debatably the world's most famous institution of secondary education. 20 of the last 60 British prime ministers were educated there. Eton has yet to integrate women, although there's a footnote here. They do have agreements with other female schools as well. And young men who attend Eton live there 7 days a week, although, of course, their families do visits. It's Hogwarts for political nerds and the privileged. And a while back, I stumbled across a news item that this was one of the questions on a recent Eton entrance exam. This is the question, and this applies to the election we're having, and it applies to these protests we've been seeing. You can apply them to protests we've seen in the past, and we can apply it to the protests we've seen in the future. Listen to this question from ordinary-times.com and Bert Lyko. Quote, "The year is 2040. There have been riots in the streets of London after Britain has run out of petrol because of an oil crisis in the Middle East. Protesters have attacked public buildings. Several policemen have died. Consequently, government has deployed the army to curb the protests. After 2 days, the protests have been put down, but 25 protesters were killed by the army. You are the prime minister. Write a script for a speech to be broadcast to the nation in which you explain why employing the army against violent protesters was the only option available to you and the one which was both necessary and moral." That's the test question. Here's what Bert Lyko wrote. "It's weird to think that this would be a significant part of how the most prestigious high school in the English-speaking world would choose to test a 12-year-old's ability as a writer. Imagine you're a prime minister is a fine beginning, I suppose, and I don't have a problem with giving intelligent 12-year-olds a very challenging question as part of an exam to gain entrance into a prestigious school. But, and now your job is to explain away something super morally questionable? That question conveys a message to a young person who is asked to respond to it. Specifically, a young person who the school's teachers have to be aware has a much higher than baseline chance of actually being a prime minister in 2040. And even if no one who found themselves tasked with writing this essay does wind up in a position of high public responsibility, I'm still kind of queasy about the implication that this is an important life skill for which a student's aptitude will be measured and presumably developed throughout the rest of the school's curriculum. A part of me hopes a decent number of these essays ended with phrases like, quote, and so it becomes the incidents happened under my custodianship of the government. I must take responsibility and I offer the monarch my resignation as prime minister. Thank you for the opportunity to serve. May the families of the fallen find comfort and solace," end quote. But I wonder if enough 12-year-olds would see that as a viable option or fear that doing so would fail the assignment. That would require a rather high degree of moral courage faced with a rather high amount of real-world risk. Easier to just complete the essay as given. Offer a justification for the peacetime deployment of the military within the civilian population and the resulting deaths. Okay, so maybe you don't need to resign to pass the test here, but I do hope what the instructors were looking for was, quote, will the student take moral responsibility as a leader for this, and if so, how? I wonder how many of the students passed this facet of the exam. and how many simply completed the assignment as given. Again, it seems like a lot to ask a 12-year-old under high pressure to gain entrance to a prestigious school. I wonder how many people aspiring to the position of political leadership would feel morally bothered by asking such a question. How many there are there who realize they seek a position in which they would be confronting with such moral question, and of those, how many of those thoughts is the answer to them, and of them, how many will stick to those answers when they are inevitably confronted with the awful reality? Leadership, and particularly high-level political leadership, will involve making choices with prices surely paid in tears, if not in blood. I doubt anyone here needs any reminder of why this point upon which I choose to meditate regarding immediate American political choices, but I also hope to inspire some thoughts about how a future generation of leaders are being educated, not just here, but globally. This was timely. When Burke put this together, he didn't know we were going to have, you know, a riot in front of Union Station where a terrorist organization was going to be spray painted. I'm sure he was thinking of things like January 6th and the Black Lives Matter riots and other instances. He's a student of history. We're getting ready to have the DNC in Chicago. We all should know, and if you don't, go Google what happened in 1968 in Chicago. We don't need that again, but we may be getting that again. There's all kinds of ugly in the world, and a lot of the ugly, if you trace it back far enough, starts with some poor leadership decisions that enabled the ugly to fester and grow. The real answer to that question, since I'm asking all of you to ponder it, I think it's only fair I give you my answer. As an analysis, I can sit back and go, well, if you have that kind of violence on the street that you have to call in the army, there were steps before that that prevented that. That means there was leadership failures leading up to that breaking out. There was also a lack of restraint with the army, because you will say things like, well, the protesters attacked the army. Well, was the army trained? Why were the protesters there in the first place? Why was there a petrol shortage because of a crisis in the Middle East? Could that have been prevented? Where was your petroleum reserves? You see, there's a thousand steps to everything that happens. And our core beliefs of this program, I say it over and over again, almost every episode, things do not happen in a vacuum. They happen in a sequence. And everything that has to do with leadership happened in a sequence of steps of how that leader performed. So how do I answer this question? I would hope I would answer it the way Burke did. This was the only option available, but in reflection, we failed the steps leading up to it. And since we failed in leadership to where violence was the only option of putting down this mob, we are no longer fit to run the government, and we'll be stepping aside, hoping the next person does better than we did. That's the correct answer. I doubt there's very many people, Eton educated or otherwise, that would get it right. Something to think about as we see more protests, as we see more violence, as we see more presidential uncertainty, political uncertainty, in a world that will always tend towards chaos unless it's very, very tightly kept from doing so. Just think on it. More Hertel right after this. Welcome back to Herd Tell. I'm going to say something here that's going to be very controversial to a lot of people, but it's something I'm thinking deeply on and I want to explore and write on and do some stuff on in the future because it's really bothering me. I don't talk about faith a whole lot. I have my own faith. I'm with Johnny Cash. I'm a Christian, but I'm a C- at best Christian, and usually I'm an F. I'm in no position to tell anybody how to conduct themselves or their faith. Because I fail in my own faith, but I do take it serious. I take it serious enough that I don't really want to talk about it on Twitter. I take it seriously enough that I don't get into arguments about it. What I believe, I do believe fully and deeply, and I believe it enough that I have a lot of conviction of how I've failed my own beliefs and faiths over large chunks of my life, and I'm trying to be a better man and a better father and a better person to the people in my life and my family, despite my failings. But there's something going on in American evangelical Christianity, and I hate the term evangelical. I could do a couple hours on why I dislike that term, even though technically I is one. I hate that terminology. It does not cover what it needs to cover. It does not mean what it originally meant. But I'm going to say this because there's been a lot of stuff that maybe if you're not of the Christian faith, you may not realize. But when you start talking about this Christian nationalism stuff, you look at things that are going on with major denominations like the Southern Baptist Convention. I've been a member of a Southern Baptist church before. I'm not currently, but I've worshiped at them frequently over the years. I grew up, I consider myself a Baptist, not a Southern Baptist, but a Baptist. I grew up in American Baptist churches, although not the national American Baptists are pretty liberal. I grew up in pretty conservative ones. That's just my background. I consider myself a Baptist. I consider myself a Christian. A very bad one, but I do consider my one. I have studied theology for over 20 years, both personally and academically. I've done quite a bit of high-level theology study academically. I'm getting ready to do more of it. I'm got some GI Bill left. I'm going to go back and study it some more. And one of the main reasons I'm going to do it is because what I've been seeing from religious leaders in the Christian evangelical community in America. This meshing of politics with the church is bad. Now, understand what I'm saying here. Yes, your convictions and faith should dictate how you see the world. It should dictate how you vote. It should dictate who you support. But that's you individually. When your church and your denomination and when your faith group as a whole becomes beholden identity-wise to politics and to political leaders, that's really bad. It's bad for your faith. It's bad for you personally in your walk in faith, and it's bad for the country, and it's bad for your church. Now, I'm just going to talk to my own community here. If you're Jewish, if you're Hindu, if you're a Sikh, if you're a Muslim, if you're a Rastafarian, God bless. Let's sit down and have some dinner and we'll talk about all this and our various beliefs. I would love to do so, but I'm going to talk to my own community since technically I is one. What has been happening in evangelical Christianity on the conservative side is troubling, but it was predictable and you could see it coming over the last 25, 30 years. What has happened in the Christian community, the American evangelical Christian community specifically? Go ahead and get mad. Send your emails, herdtaleshow@gmail.com, herdtaleshow on the Twitter. Go ahead and send your hate. I'm going to say this, and I believe it to the core of my being. One of the big problems with evangelical Christianity in America is they really are the spoiled rich kids of the faith world. Worldwide, there has never been a group, a religious faith group in the history of the world, unless you want to maybe count Constantine making Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, which was the start of the decline, frankly. No religious group has ever benefited more than post-World War II American evangelical Christianity. Prosperity-wise, politically-wise, political power-wise, lack of persecution, ability to do whatever you want, it's inarguable. Historically, no group of faith has ever prospered like post-World War II evangelical Christianity in the United States of America. That's an inarguable statement. But what did they do with it? What did we do with it? Because it's only fair to include myself here. Well, church attendance is down. Baptisms are down. Belief in the faith is down. Those two things are incongruent. How can you be that prosperous and yet people outside of your faith are rejecting it? And by the way, the more politically aligned you get to try to get your power and influence and to get those heady post-World War II days back, the worse this is going to get. There should be some reflection of why those two things are both true. Why after a period of almost unrivaled prosperity for a faith group, they are being rejected more and more and more by more and more people. It's inarguable. Church attendance is down. Baptisms are down. I know the Southern Baptists will say certain baptismal figures. Look, it's down. Maybe you should get your faith centered over something more than politics. I am very troubled And I said I could see this coming because what happened with the church growth movement over the last 30, 35 years and what's happened in the seminaries and the type of pastors they're putting out. Look, I took classes at Liberty. I know some of these folks. I know what I'm talking about here. And I'm going to be in the vast minority of people that will say this, and lots of people will tell me I need to shut up. I will not, but I will be drowned out saying this. I think we really failed in not making seminary students work some kind of public-facing service sector job for 6 months to a year as part of their training. We are pumping out these pastors that don't know anything other than being leaders without having been led themselves. We have a prodigious amount of people who call themselves pastors in Christian evangelicalism in America who obviously have not done enough business with the devil themselves to take their chosen vocation seriously. They think it's some kind of Salesforce, something or other, church growth business model. And there's too much business models in the churches and there's not enough faith. And when you have a business model that mashes with a political ideology, you have a recipe for some earthly success, but don't call it faith and don't call it a church. And that's where we're at with that. I could go really deep in the woods on the theology and ideology and the politics and the religion and all of that. I've studied it for all of my adult life because I care about it. I can go quote you the verses if you really want to. We can talk about how we got here with certain faith leaders. But things like the scandals where churches aren't held accountable for abuse because it would be bad for the brand, where we have to prop up political candidates who most people wouldn't allow membership of in their own churches, but we have to have them because they're going to make the church great again. I'm sorry, you've lost the plot. That's not how that works. It breaks my heart and it frustrates me because evangelical Christian faith is based on a message of forgiveness and repentance and redemption. And so many of those people are using things like forgiveness, repentance, and redemption not as a shield to protect vulnerable people who are trying to work out their faith and find a better way through this thing we call life, but they're using it as a sword to cut down anybody that opposes them. That's not faith. That's theocracy. And I'll have no part of it. And I'm done being quiet about it. More Herd Tell right after this. Welcome back to Herd Tell. Let's end on a good note. That's enough heavy stuff. Katie Coyne, who's a tremendous reporter in the state of West Virginia. She writes for West Virginia Watch, where I'm getting ready to join them as a regular contributor on commentary. But she does the real work. She's an actual journalist. I just play one on TV from time to time. So ever since there's this scandal in West Virginia where they painted Baby Dog, that's Jim Justice's obesely cute, obesely fat, and very beloved bulldog Baby Dog, into a mural on when the murals, when they painted the Capitol here recently. That guy's resigned, by the way, but to kind of mock that and bring attention to it, Katie Coyle has started on social media putting Baby Dog in famous paintings and doing it every day until, quote, I forget to do it. And the Washingtonian has actually picked this up. This is by Sylvie McNamara. For the past month, Katie Coyne, a state government reporter at the nonprofit newsroom West Virginia Watch, has dabbled in something akin to endurance art. Each day, she photoshops Baby Dog, the West Virginia Governor Jim Justice celebrity bulldog, into a famous painting. Baby Dog sniffing the carnage of Granicea, awaiting scraps beneath the table of the Last Supper, or frolicking naked in the Garden of Earthly Delights. Okay, we didn't need that. In one, Baby Dog's face becomes the head of the Van Gogh sunflower. That was one of my favorites. In another, the dog is perched atop God's back as he stretches his finger forward to Adam, endowing him with a spark of life on the Vatican ceiling. My personal favorite, there's the famous mob scene painting, and it's got Jim Justice holding Baby Dog's butthole up during the State of the State, where he was making fun of Beth Midler.
These are just classic. You got to go through them. But anyway, back to the piece. Coin tweets these images daily. They're silly, but they're also pointed, a response to a stranger-than-fiction incident back in June when Baby Dog's likeness was spotted in a historic mural that had just been unveiled at the state capitol. For a few days, reporters struggled to get the basic answers because we can't get any answers out of the Justice Administration. To get basic answers about how and why the Baby Dog is in the painting, so Crone photoshopped a droll critique of the governor's chilly relationship with the press. It's not chilly. It's non-existent. Anyway, now Coin's durational performance has lasted more than a month. Day 35 was Baby Dog in the Bruegel painting of a 16th century greyhound. I called her to chat about these things, and there's an interview, and it's fantastic. Read the whole thing, but just a little lighthearted. This is something new in media that I think is effective. If you can use humor, if you can use a little bit of mocking to get your point across, it's extremely effective, good for Katie Coyne. Again, full disclosure, starting 1 August, I will be collecting a check from West Virginia Watch, but I'm proud to do so. They do really good work. I'm excited to write commentary for them. It's a great opportunity for me. But check out Katie Coyne. We're going to link to the piece in the Washingtonian. Check out all the tweets on Baby Dog and Famous. Baby Dog and American Gothic is classic. You just got to see these. It's a lot of fun. We will link to all the pieces. That'll do it for Herd Tell. We covered a lot of bases today. Make sure you check out the podcast, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, any platform you can think of, domestic and or internationally. We're on a couple over in India, believe it or not. Hi, India. We see you. Appreciate y'all. Over in the UK, France, we're on a couple different platforms. Please make sure you subscribe. And if you have the ability to leave a comment and a rating, please do so. That's really important. That lets those platforms know that our program is worth promoting and supporting. It lets other people know what you think. We greatly appreciate it. We don't pay for any advertising outside of our own social media accounts here. So if you do us a favor, it only costs you a click. If you'd use another click to share us on your social media, we would sure appreciate it. Also, the full archive of Herd Tell is now up on YouTube. It took us about a week and a half to get that all on there because it's over 700 episodes. There is a podcast-specific tab on YouTube. This is more kind of a new feature YouTube done. There's so many podcasts that people, they quote-unquote watch them on YouTube, but it's just the audio with a graphic, and people listen to them as I drive. That also gets us on YouTube Music. That has all been set up. It's up and running. We had a couple glitches because YouTube gave us a couple strikes on stuff that had been up for years. We've got that all lined out now. 700 episodes and all the new ones on the podcast tab on YouTube. So if you got a YouTube account, please make sure you subscribe and follow us there. Click the notification button. You'll never miss a thing. So wherever you are, across the street and around the world, we hope you're well. We hope you are well fed. And we will talk to you again soon for more Herd Tell. All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.